This is the parasha of Sodom and Gomorrah, Sodom and Gomorrah, where Abraham calls upon God's sense of justice and mercy to redeem the city, lest even 10 persons of righteousness be found there. And shortly thereafter, we have the scenes of Lot, his daughters, their husbands, Lot's wife, Lot's family, being called to flee. We don't learn is how big his family was. Typically, families back then were fairly large, you know, almost clan-sized. You'd have uncles, aunts, cousins in sort of a related compound sharing space. And presumably when the two angels disguised in the guise of men came to the house and said, you all have to leave, get your in-laws, your chotnav, out. There were a good handful of people. I've always wondered, wouldn't there be at least 10 just in that family? Wouldn't Lot's family have been enough for Abraham to win his dispute with God? Be that as it may, since we don't know the exact numbers, it's not a striking or conclusive piece of evidence. But what it suggests to me is that there was something faulty in Lot that there was not in Abraham or in others, that Lot was almost an afterthought. That's essentially the way it appears in the text. Abraham's dispute, the dispute isn't finalized. And then suddenly you get the story of Lot, the angels, the men of town wishing to have carnal relations with Lot's guests. There's something inefficient, incomplete about Lot, and I think one of them is his sense of discernment. So I want to talk to you about three potential roles one can take in life, three stances to truth, to dispute, to ethics, that I think are somewhat represented in this parasha. There's the judge, the prophet, and the jester. And I think there is a hierarchy among those stances of how we view ethics, how we view each other, how we comport ourselves in the world. So Lot and Abraham start discussing God's justice. That famous, famous line, HaShofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat. Using almost a play on words or a syllogism, the judge of all earth won't do righteousness, won't do justice, Abraham calls to God. One of his final pleas and final arguments against God destroying the cities of the plain. You are known as the true judge. How could you not do justice? Which suggests, and you'll see it in the text I was going to hand out, some of the same questions that Plato raised in the dialogues of Euthyphro. Are things just because God loves them, or does God love them because they are just? Which intimates, is there a standard of justice that is external to the divine? Is there some isolated, inexplicable, and unreachable standard that even God adheres to? That's a dialogue for another day, but it is on the sheet that I was unable to hand you. It's in the back. Brian will have it when you leave. And then a few verses later, after Abraham calls out to God, won't the judge of all the earth do justly? The people of Sodom say to Lot, you know, you came here to live with us, and now you set yourself up in judgment over us. When he won't release his visitors to be assaulted by the crowd. I think he's doing the right thing there, clearly. Although, scant verses later, he says, you know, take my girls. If you don't assault the men, take my girls. So there's something faulty with Lot for a lot of reasons. But that question of justice, there's a Kabbalistic principle that there are two sides to the divine, that there are principles and subsets of the Godhead, and on one line are the attributes of strict justice, and on the other line are the attributes of mercy. And the attributes of strict justice often get God, so to speak, in trouble more often than the lines of mercy. So our medieval commentators look at Abraham's query to God about doing justice. And they say that if you were the judge of the whole earth, it would defame your image. If you judge people on the conduct of the majority, you'll have to destroy all of humankind, seeing that most people everywhere are wicked. At least the majority, or at least a plurality of people, are wicked. That's an interesting survey to take. I don't know. And you would be perceived ill by the populace if one were to view you as killing the righteous along with the wicked. That's the stance of judgment, of rushing to judgment on a terror suspect before we know his complicity in the crime, of making assessments of people who disagree with us based on our own desire to be in the right. That's the standard of justice, I think, that we are enjoined not to follow to the letter. Certainly our sages in Talmud, especially in the book of Sanhedrin, violated principles of severe justice in favor of, if not leniency, then at least compassion. I'm going back to the question of why I don't give many political sermons. So someone was visiting me this week and gave me a sermon from someone in Atlanta. And this sermon was based around political issues to which I disagree. And I can't tell you how much of that factored into my strong aversion, if not disgust, at this sermon. Because it was, as Karen pointed out, the word she used was grandstanding. That's a problem. That's why I don't speak on politics, at least not in that way. My job isn't to tell you what to think or to tell you exactly what I think. My job is to ask you to think. And that's, I think, the weakness of being the judge, is that arrogance of claiming to have the right answer, to think there is everywhere at all times only one answer. And that if enough people are wicked, you might as well destroy the whole experiment and start from scratch. Abraham tends in another direction. So Rabbi David Kimchi of France in about the 12th century looks at this statement, Hashofet kol ha'aretz lo yaseh mishpat, won't the judge of all earth do justly, do justice, and puts in Abraham's mouth, as our sages were wont to do, saying, I didn't mean to protest your judgment, I just wish to understand it. That's, I think, the first crack in our arrogance towards other people's opinions. We can't understand other people as being polar or binary or distinct, monolithic. People have variety and people have confusion and people contain multitudes within. And our first question should be, let me understand what you're saying before I disagree with it categorically. That's what marks Abraham as a prophet. This week we see the first instance, as far as I know, of the word Navi, prophet. Which, of course, being the first instance, when Abraham's called a prophet in the episode of Abimelech, our sages don't know what that means. You know, you look at the first instance of a word's usage and you have to infer its meaning to an extent. So Rashbam, one of Rashi's descendants, looks at that word and I think gives this really sweet definition, that a prophet is one, this is in God's voice, who is familiar to me, speaks my language, and I love to listen to his prayer. That there's a warmth, there's an intimacy between the divine, the almighty, and the prophet. That relationship is mediated by compassion and love rather than sternness and strict justice. That there is a desire on the part of both God and the prophet to face each other as the kruvim, as the cherubs would, to look at each other, to understand each other, to listen, to speak to each other in warm and intimate tones, to be heard, not just to shout and grandstand, but to use our ears before we use our mouth. Or as I think also Plato said, you know, apocryphally, we have two eyes, two ears, and one mouth, and we should use them in that proportion. So part, again, of what makes Abraham so powerful is not just the intimacy, not just the empathy, but the modeling. That a prophet, unlike a judge, and I don't mean this literally in the sense of judges who sit at benches and prophets who wail in the streets, but those metaphors of leadership and of ethical good standing, are prophets are models. Judges can just render judgment and go home and there was a judge here who had a significant drug problem that compromised a lot of his rulings not so long ago, right? There was an inauthenticity or a lack of integrity. I don't mean that his judgments weren't fair, but that the inside didn't match the outside. So going a bit into our mystical traditions, the Sefer HaBahir, which may have been the first century, it may have been the 13th century, depending on how it was attributed, puts in the word of the divine attribute of chesed, again, along the lines of the compassionate rubric of God, rather than the stern rubrics that God lives in, or the ways we understand God. That God's compassion, God's chesed, God's loving kindness says, as long as Abraham was around, there was nothing for me to do. He did my work instead, in my stead. And that's the prophet. That's the prophetic in all of us. That's the prophetic call of Isaiah and Ezekiel and Amos and Micah to be godlike, to do imitatio Dei, to imitate God in the public sphere, to show justice as an expression of love. That's what Cornel West said, that justice is what love looks like in public. That's real ethics. It's not just being a judge from afar, but stepping into the mix with your modeling, with your seriousness, with your love and compassion for your fellow human. We see this in another mystic source, the Zohar. When they look at Noah and Abraham, and I think I've talked to you about this classical story of Noah being righteous for his generation, but Abraham being effectively or empirically righteous. The question being, you know, was Noah, we're told, he was righteous in his generation. That's the first word of the second parsha of our Torah, first phrase. And the question comes up, so would he have been righteous if he had known Abraham? Or was he only relatively righteous to the wickedness of his age? And typically what's accounted not in his favor is that when God told Noah that the world was to be destroyed, Noah said, how big a boat do I build? And Abraham, when told that a few cities would be destroyed, Abraham wheedled and grappled with God. But another interesting point is that Noah set about building an ark that would shelter a handful of righteous individuals, so maybe not so bad, remaining in a corrupt world. In addition, Midrash describes that he tried to convince his generation to mend their ways and be saved. So we don't get it in the text that he sought out God and wrestled with God, but he at least spoke as a prophet might to his generation and addressed and tried to lift people out of the morass of their own immorality. But what he didn't do, he didn't pray for them the way Abraham did. He didn't open his heart to them, recognizing his own flaws and weaknesses and in some ways his powerlessness to change them. He showed them the boat. He said, get on, change your ways, the way Jonah did to an extent. He got the righteous together, but he wasn't open to true repentance, to their own suffering, to the fact that these people were not universally wicked, that they were wicked enough to be destroyed, but there may have been something that could be salvaged. That's the attitude of a prophet over a judge, is the recognition that these people, all of them, are worth listening to, are worth saving, are worth working with. You might disagree with them. Your neighbor might vote differently than you. Your friends might have different opinions on the just distribution of wealth or voting patterns, but that doesn't make them invalid. Now, there are, as we've talked about, the Overton window of the acceptable discourse in public. There are things we can't tolerate. White supremacy, you know, for some, it might be communism, but for most things, there is a valid amount of discourse and conversation to be had. So this great little clip on YouTube, you know how YouTube offers you ads before the clip you want to see. So this was an ad. I didn't tag it. I didn't follow it along to see if it's a real thing, but I loved the ad. It was Halloween costumes. This was after Halloween, so I wonder if it was more a joke. And it was Halloween costumes to address the degradation of civic discourse. So they had Halloween costumes for liberals to inflame your conservative friends, and Halloween costumes for conservatives to inflame your liberal friends. The one I remember, the liberal costume was a non-gendered bathroom, and the conservative costume was a Trump voter with a PhD. So he had arm patches on his blazer, but the red hat. which conceals comb-overs, I think is what it's for. That's a piece of it, and I think that's the balance. If you can't get there through compassion alone, get there from humor. My rabbi, my mentor, is a percussionist, and his teacher taught him two things that I remember. One, that playing the triangle is harder than it looks, but not much. Also true of a harmonica. But the important one was in holding the mallets for timpani. If you never drop your mallet, you're holding it too tight. Learn to laugh at yourself. Learn to laugh at your opinions. Learn to see that you're not complete. That's I think, the difference between, and how you get there, between being a prophet, a judge and a prophet, is the sense of your own fallibility and a little bit of irreverence towards your own beliefs. You know, everyone on the political spectrum, certainly those at the ends, don't see their blind spots. That's what I find most, the two things I find most infuriating are people not seeing their blind spots and people not talking to people who disagree. That's what's tearing our country apart. You know, if you can't see your own hypocritical beliefs, if you can't see the weakness of certain arguments you make, you're not ready. Our sages knew that. I mean, the reason they favored Hillel over Shammai was that Hillel learned Shammai's arguments before they would make their own. And this is a parsha I want to leave you with a lot of laughter. That word, tzadi chet kuf, that root is repeated a few times. That's what Yitzhak's name comes from. Sarah says, I laughed thinking that I wouldn't be pregnant, so I'll name him Laughter, effectively. That was the joy occasioned by the miracle she experienced, said one of our sages. And elsewhere in the Talmud, among other things, among other persons who have a share in the world to come, are jesters, because they make peace among other people by making them laugh. I'm not saying to be trivializing or irreverent at moments of seriousness, but maybe self-effacing. Self-deprecating, not taking yourself too seriously, I think is extremely important. And that's the transition, that's the bridge between the judge who views everyone not like him or her as a fool or a knave, and the prophet who walks among the people, who relates to God in an intimate way through prayer and understanding and compassion, listens to others, learns their argument and their core beliefs first, learns their needs before he or she states his or her own. And it's not grandstanding. That's no one's job, is to just yell louder than the next person. That's really what you want. You should be a disc jockey on some sort of extreme radio show. But I couldn't imagine having one of them in my congregation.